Hello, everybody, and welcome back to Season 3, Episode 11 of Mind Clickers, where it's time to click both heads when in 2022. Today, I have the absolute pleasure of jumping on and having a live chat with the man, the myth, the legend, Endpoint Eclipse. How you going, man?
Good, thanks. How are you?
I'm brilliant. I'm really pretty good. We had a little bit of a pre-chat banter before we hit that live button. I'm feeling good. You know, everything's been going pretty good over here. Obviously, we were just chatting about it. Obviously, we weren't able to, you know, unfortunately make the major, and it's pretty much a waiting game for us at this point. So, it's going to be an interesting dynamic to see how KCP and Power perform at the major because, you know, their performance is based on whether we go to Worlds. So it's going to be an interesting one, but definitely looking forward to seeing how it goes.
Yeah, I mean, I look forward to the major anyway. I'm going to be there regardless of if we qualify for it. Hopefully I'm there in a competitive outcome, but, you know, can't choose everything.
That's it, for sure. So what we usually do is, obviously, pretty much for all episodes of MindClick, is just send into that the anime intro arc, I like to call it. So I guess take us back, I guess, into the early days of, you know, when you started to consider, you know, esports, when you even got into Rocket League and how even that process began as a whole.
All right. Well, I actually owned Rocket League since, I think, 2 days after it launched, released.
Yep.
I played it for 2 hours with a friend, absolutely despised the game, and didn't touch it for 2 years. So that was my start in Rocket League.
That's like me.
I was in school then, and a mate of mine in school was talking about Rocket League, and I was like, oh, I've got that game, I can play that with you, because, like, me and him always struggled to find things to play, because he loved, like, Japanese RPGs and stuff, and I was very much more of a, you know, competitive game kind of person, and so that was something, and so we started playing it, and that was when I got into it, and so, like, at the very end of Season 3, we got to, like, Challenger Elite or whatever it was. We were very good. I was on keyboard and mouse. It was not a great start. then, you know, I just progressed through the game, kind of left my friends behind a little bit, which was a bit sad, but, you know, it is how it is.
Yeah.
And then in terms of actually getting into coaching, it all started from uni, actually. So I was doing University Rocket League. I was playing in the university leagues, doing decent, but I was never one of the best players. I was always, like, champion around there. So I was always challenging the top of better players, but never really good enough. So I ended up starting to try and coach the first team a bit in uni. That helped. They made, like, top three or whatever in the UK, something like that. I can't remember exactly. And through it, I made friends with, like, Tadpole, Speed, people like that. Then I went to Gfinity Elite Series, saw that coaches were a genuine thing with Greg and stuff. And it was an actual viable option kind of thing. And I was like, oh, damn, that's pretty, you know, that's pretty cool.
Yeah.
I was doing physics at the time in uni. So, like, I did a lot of analytical stuff with that anyway. So, like, I knew I can know how to analyze things. So I was like, okay, maybe I'll give that a go. Went to DreamHack Leipzig then in 2019. I helped out a couple of the teams there. I helped out Mindset, which was Ocelon, Calyx, and Astral. That was a team. They knocked out Rogue day one, and Rogue went home, like, but early. They bought new flights and just left. That was an interesting experience. But yeah, I remember talking to, like, Fireworks and stuff from EG and things, and I was in the player area just doing my stuff. And, you know, I then got home and was like, damn, I want to do that full time. I want to do that as my job.
Yeah.
And so I did the very probably idiotic thing, really, of dropping out of uni there and then.
Okay.
And I gave myself a deadline of, I think I had 9 months to make it into esports. Got picked up by, I saw a tweet by Vert asking for a coach for their team, which was Vert, Sharp, and Wave.
Right.
I coached them. They gave me, like, a 2-week trial period, which ended quite quickly because after the first couple of sessions with them, they wanted to keep me. So that was a good confidence booster.
Nice.
We made top 8 in the play-ins for LRS, so just missed out on making LRS first time. Then went away, I did casting and all that. Came back, Wave was trying to make his team for Season 8 RLCS, RLRS. And him and Natch picked up Vert, they brought me on. They asked me to come back as a coach. I didn't even like ask. I said that I'd be happy to do it, but I never actually asked to do it.
Right.
So they offered it back to me, which I, again, another massive ego boost.
Yeah.
and then, you know, we made it to LRS. We were the first all-rookie team to make RLCS. And then, you know, the rest is history, really. We dropped Nash, picked up Meta, dropped Vert, picked up Seiko. Seiko got bought, we picked up Archie. Pretty much how it's gone since.
Love that. Phenomenal. Now, I love the fact that you picked up Rocket League for a short time and then dropped it straight away, because that's exactly what I did. I picked it up, I want to say like 2016. I put like an hour into it. And back then, I was on keyboard and mouse. And at the time, all my mates were on using controllers. And I'm like, nah, I'm not spending $20 to get a controller to play this game. I'm not doing that. So then I just refused to play it. And then somehow, you know, found myself back into it. What, like, I want to say...
Well, that controller thing is actually a good point. So for me, it wasn't so much... the controller problem I had wasn't because I didn't have any. Like, I have, like, a million controllers. Like, you can see a controller box actually right there.
That's my favorite. So, yeah.
My problem was is that I played a lot of COD, and I was, like, Master League 2 and stuff in Black Ops 2. And that meant my grip was on a controller was very unorthodox. It was very much COD grip, and that was it.
Yeah.
And I didn't really... Other than playing FIFA, which I didn't have to try with anyway, like... Your grip was very hard to change. So I think it was at the end of season 5, I was silver 3 or something on keyboard and mouse. And I finally got fed up because my friends were all like gold 3 or whatever. And I was always keeping up with them, but I could just never physically do the mechanics they were doing. And I was so I just said, fuck this. Oh shit.
You're all good. You're all good. Okay, we allowed. It's all right.
Okay, fair enough. The worst part was I said that, and I went, oh shit.
We're clipping that.
Yeah, so and then at the end of season 5, I was like, okay, no, I need to get on this controller. So I spent, I think, like 10 hours in casuals just figuring out how I can do my binds and everything to work with my grip. But the thing is, my grip's changed now. Because of my binds, my grip on the controller's actually changed to just... suit those binds more than the grip in the first place. So
right.
But then in season 6, then I went from silver 3 to like champ 1, all because I changed the controller. It was a crazy like ascendancy,
right?
And then I just kept getting better. I think season 8 or 9, I first hit GC, but that was back in the days where you had to get that was when they started bringing out you had to get the rewards. Yep. So I didn't actually get the titles for it. I just hit it and dipped back into champ 3 or something.
Right.
But I think season 10 was the first season I got GC rewards, actually.
Okay, gotcha.
Which is foreign to any people that only know the free to play version right now, because they're like, season 10? It's only season 6.
Yeah. I remember buying it back in the day. I like that you mentioned COD grip. Did you used to use claw grip? You used to be a claw player on COD? Yeah. I still am a claw player, and I can't go back now. Like, I'm perma stuck claw player.
Well, so basically. The biggest problem I had was because obviously your fingers like this, right?
Yeah, like that.
I could never use the buttons properly because I'd always start like getting in the way of myself when I was trying to play Rocket League. Because obviously X was power slide, Y was ball cam, B was boost, A was jump. And I was like, there's no way that I can do all these things with just one finger. Because in COD, you can always just do one or the other. And so but I didn't care about the game enough, essentially, back in the day.
Right.
To even bother trying to change it. So, like, or to get used to it. So, in the end, that was why. So, then I put boost, I think. What I did was I put boost on RB to pull my finger off the buttons.
Right.
So that I left my finger on boost. And so then my thumb then just did A and X, because I used to have power slide still on there, but I had air roll on LT. I've changed my binds actually recently. It made me so bad at the game. I took I think a whole 2 seasons of in-game seasons to like get used to the binds. It was not a good idea.
Yeah.
Because as a coach, I don't play the game anywhere near as much as a pro player does. So I can't get used to new binds as quickly.
Yeah.
So but the problem was because I was so shit with them, it made me actually take longer to get used to the binds because I kept not wanting to play because I was doing bad. And it was there was a whole mental block thing.
You've brought up an interesting topic, one that we haven't chatted about before, the whole fact of claw grip versus normal grip. Because do you know any other pro players who use claw grip? Because I know that Fever does, and he'll abide by it forever. But do you know any of the people who use claw grip? I mean, is there an advantage of using claw grip over normal grip, do you reckon?
I actually can't tell you, to be honest. Like, it's something that you, I feel like you don't really look at. You don't really pay any attention to. Because I think there's a couple of people I know that play this after COD, and I'm assuming all of them have claw grip. You just have to. Because you have to be able to press all the buttons at once.
Yeah, you got to double tap. Like,
yeah, exactly. So, like, I can imagine, but I assume most people that come from FIFA and stuff, they probably don't. Because there's no reason to be claw grip in that game. If you never played like a competitive thing on a controller, you have like almost no reason to be claw grip.
Yeah.
Because claw grip's all about speed, right?
Yeah.
It's the quickest way to press X, A, and Y all at the same time. that's essentially the best way to do it. So, yeah.
It's interesting. I actually hadn't thought about that in depth. It's just one of the things that I did, but now, I remember Fever talking about it. I remember him talking about he used to have like thumb problems, and then he worked out it was just like a buildup of synovial fluid in his thumb. And I gave him some exercise to relieve that. And he doesn't really get that anymore. But yeah, it's an interesting one because I wonder if like longevity term wise, like what kind of ongoing issues can happen because obviously it's in an unnatural position. So, but yeah, it's an interesting area.
So I know Wave isn't a claw player. But he had issues with his thumb as well because of like the thing. So what he's had to do now is so I play with my thumb like this on the controller, and that's what Wave did as well.
Yeah.
But Wave found that he started struggling to be able to turn right in the game
because
of it.
Okay.
Because of his thumb was like tensing up and stuff, so he was struggling to push across. So he's now had to force himself to play like this.
Oh.
So he's actually had to change his grip to that.
Gotcha.
Because then it keeps his thumb less tense, essentially.
Yeah.
So, like, I think you're going to start finding that a lot of pros are probably going to have to start, like, fine-tuning their grip to, like, suit, you know, land, you know, some people have bigger hands. Like, I have a massive hands compared to Wave because I'm like, triple his size. and so, like, a controller for me is always going to be much smaller in my hand. So I can probably do that thumb grip a lot better than he can and a lot more efficiently because I have a lot wider range of movement. But someone who like just did that as a kid but never quite grew into the controller might start struggling with it then later in life kind of thing. So I think that's where the whole grip thing will come into play more so than affecting binds because you just change your binds to what grip you want to hold, really.
Yeah. Now, I asked Greg in this, and it was an interesting question, and the way that he framed it was quite interesting. I'm keen to hear your thoughts on it. When you started coaching, I guess in comparison to you coaching now, has your viewpoint of coaching changed over time? And I guess like the way you coach, your reaction towards dealing with a loss, your reaction towards dealing with when you're actually dealing with problems, has that changed over time, do you think, and has it gotten better?
I think I've got better as a coach, but I think that's just because I understand the game better.
Right.
Like, but I wouldn't say the way I coach necessarily has changed. So I've always had it. So I coached a bit of football and stuff, and I enjoyed doing that with like six aside and like setting up the right team and things like that.
Awesome.
And so I've always had that background, and I always loved analyzing rugby, football, whatever as a kid. Because I played them all. So I understood those games way better because I was very good at them at a young age. Obviously, it was only more recently in my Rocket League career, I guess, I became what would be considered a very good player, you know, in the GCs, etc.
Yeah.
So I think my biggest problem coming up was I understood the fundamentals of the game, but I didn't quite understand the full motion of the mechanics. So how much space did they need for it? How much time did they need for it? And that's something that I've developed over time. Which I think is a good thing that I started with a bubble team for that reason, because the bubble players needed more help on the fundamentals than they did on the mechanics.
Right.
Whereas higher level teams need both. And so I think having that way of coming into it, I was able to develop my mechanical understanding. But my way of coaching is to not think I'm the dog's bollocks. I think too many coaches think they're infallible and that their way is gospel.
Yeah.
Whereas, like, when Archie first joined the team, I literally got on a call with him and I was like, look, I'm probably going to be wrong. Tell me when you think I'm wrong.
Yeah.
Because, like, I want input from the players. Like, there's no help. There's no use in trying to tell a person what to do if they're not going to respect you because they don't think you're right.
Yep.
So and that's always been my thing. So, like, and we obviously have Callum, our psychologist, and I always used to run past him my things with coaching and my coaching style that I used to always do, and he was always like, yeah, that's the way you should do it. And I'm like, okay, well then there's my gratification from it. Like,
there's my affirmation.
So I've just continued doing that because I don't, like, the best way to teach someone is to let them think they taught themselves.
Mm-hmm.
Someone's going to be less likely to disagree with them than with you. So if you basically show them something that's wrong and go, so what's wrong here? And they go, well, you should do this, and that's the right thing. Then you go, yeah, well, then you should do that. And then they're like, damn, yeah, okay, I'll do that. And then they think, and you know, while you obviously knew it and you could have just told them straight away, it's always better for them to figure it out themselves. And that's something I've never changed. So I think back to the starting question, other than my knowledge improving of the game, I wouldn't say my coaching's ever changed.
Mm, yeah, interesting. I think from my perspective, it's interesting as well, because obviously I didn't start coaching in Rocket League. Like, I used to originally coach StarCraft 2, and that's obviously a very different game to Rocket League, right? And obviously a very different sort of understanding and sort of approach you need for that sort of game. And then I dipped into CS a little bit, and then obviously then came into Rocket League. So I already had sort of a different foundation of games and sort of that underlying problem-solving aspect on how to approach it. But obviously I'm not more of a game coach, right? So. But I think it's interesting, and I really do agree with the way of just letting the players understand, because at the end of the day, you know, they know what's best for them, right? I'm not going to teach CJ how to shoot. You know, I'm not going to teach Fever how to flip reset. You know, I'm not going to teach Kami how to defend as third man, right? These sort of underlying fundamentals that a coach embodies. And I think it's interesting because I think I saw a Reddit thread or a Reddit post the other day, and it was sort of a thread on coaching and this sort of momentum-based wave that we have, where we have some game coaches, we have coaches that are known as performance coaches, we have people that are known as hype men, and we also have, you know, a wide variety of other additional support staff for a team. I think it's interesting because you could say, which is the best type of coach for a team? But is there? I don't think there is. I think it always comes down to the players, right?
If the only thing that would be objectively the best is the coach that can do all three.
Yeah.
And, like, I like to, like, I always try to approach my coaching as a tactical, like, strategic coach.
Mm-hmm.
But, like, when I was first brought on by Wave and Verge back in the day, it was to help with mentality.
Yeah.
And not so much, like, be a hype man, but it was to help them be able to calm and how to work. So, basically what you do and what Callum does for us now. And, like, I knew, like, from my own life experiences, essentially, and from playing in sports and stuff as a kid, you know, I made finals and things in rugby and football, so I knew how to calm nerves, I knew how to do all that. So I used my basic understanding of how to do it to help them, and it did help. But then I also moved into the more tactical side of thing, and that's where I'd say I am more now today, because I do more replay analysis with them, and, like, we'll discuss issues and we'll discuss how a team affects how we play, what affects what we play. And I think the biggest fallacy that we have in the scene right now is that the only people that can be tactical coaches are ex-pros. Mm. And I don't really understand where that thought process comes from. Because as you'll know from a performance coach, like, being a coach has nothing to do with your prior experience. It almost always has if you're even capable of analyzing and coaching. It has nothing really to do whether you were a pro or not.
Yep.
You know, K-Dop can be considered the GOAT. Doesn't mean he's going to be a good coach.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Like, just because he can play the game well doesn't mean he can explain the game well.
Yeah.
Or at least see the things that need to change. And don't get me wrong, there's a lot of pro players in Rocket League that can do that, because I think Rocket League is a bit more unique in that situation, where I think there are those players. Meta, I guarantee you, if Meta became a coach, he would be a great coach. And so there are definitely people out there that can do that. But But like, I started doing gameplay coaching when I was champ 2 or something. I was not very good at the game, but like the boys I coached to the level to a thing that the boys needed coaching for. I didn't try and outstep my bounds. Because as you said, I can flip reset. I know how to tell someone how to flip reset. I can probably teach someone how to flip reset, but it doesn't mean I'm going to teach a pro how to be better at flip resets.
Yeah.
Like, I've set up, like, shooting practices and stuff for the boys because I think shooting is fundamental enough that I can have an effect on how to improve that. And it's the same with dribbling and stuff. But, like, the more advanced mechanics, that is for them. If that is for you to go to them and go, look, I've watched your game. I've seen that your double touches seem a bit inconsistent. Your flip resets are a bit inconsistent. Maybe you want to improve these so that we have a bit more individual offensive powerhouse.
Yeah.
Like offensive power. And then I tell them, I say, go take 2 hours a week to go and practice this. I can't tell them how to because they already know how to. But I'm just directing them that that's something they need to improve. And I think that's the part that, like, yeah, and that's what I mean when I say, like, I think some coaches think they're infallible, so they think that they can give a two-hour session on how to do it better kind of thing, which is a bit of a weird one.
yeah, for sure. Now, what I was also going to add on to the end of that is you see it in some traditional sports as well, and I guess when I had my first stint at rugby as well, where do you breach the line between overcoaching? So obviously you can get to this mindset of obviously in your perspective – Looking at replays. Where do you draw the line whereby you think, okay, this is what I've taken from this replay analysis session. I'm going to utilize that into tomorrow's scrims, or I'm going to utilize that into next week's regional. But obviously, you go the extra point. You can look into another one, and you can start looking at different factors and different variables. Is there a line that you draw between that and what you want to look for in terms of replay analysis?
Yes. So I only, and I will exclusively only ever watch replays if it's a team that regularly beats us, because they're clearly doing something that we need to sort out.
Yep.
Because they've exploited a weakness in our game plan. Or if we're or if we've just lost. So in the case we are with Archie now, we're going to be doing way more replay analysis now than we would if in 6 months' time. Because now is all about breaking down the habits that he had from his team, breaking down Waves and Meta's habits, and repurposing them into doing what we need to do to make this team work.
Yep.
And so right now, I think overcoaching is a lot harder to do. But, like, for example, I did replay analysis with the boys yesterday with Wave and Meta yesterday, individual, on our Moist series where we got reverse swept.
Uh-huh.
And there are just sometimes replays that we sat there almost in silence for the most of it, just chatting about life, because there wasn't actually much to talk about. There was, you know, a bit to improve upon and boost you and do this there, but like it wasn't such a massive issue with the game that I was stopping every 2 minutes to point out you're doing this, and this wrong, because that shows progression in our habit breaking and stuff. And that then is when you start realizing, okay, well, I don't need to do replays for a while. Because as you said, if you start doing replays all the time, you can start making bad habits by trying to force things.
Yeah.
Because just because someone makes a mistake once doesn't mean it's something they're consistently making.
Mm-hmm.
So say if I did a replay analysis over the two regionals that we won. If I'm doing replay analysis on those regionals, then I'm probably just finding things that were working and telling them to stop. Because you don't know from the individual replay how much of an effect that's having on the series. Like, we would do replay analysis on, like, one team if they beat us particularly hard or something. Yep. Again, that's because they might have found a weakness, so we're looking to see if they found a weakness or if we just played shit or if they just did good that day.
Yeah.
And so that's where my line is, essentially, is when you're playing well, you don't need to worry about it.
Yeah, for sure. And what's your approach? Because I guess I completely agree with that. I think that, obviously, from my perspective, I do a ton of replays individually just so I can have a look and sort of understand a bit more stuff. And I do sort of stuff with the boys, sort of one-on-one go through replays, but not as much as something like a gameplay coach would do, just because I'm looking for different things. But how do you go about, I guess, when it is, you know, looking into Sweden or looking into, you know, LA, when you're versing international teams, a lot of teams tend to have the mindset of, okay, we're versing, say, for example, in your situation, okay, we're versing NRG, you know, let's look at NRG, but how far do you strive from actually playing how you want to play? Because a lot of teams will sometimes go out the way of playing differently just so they can beat this one particular team, but then sort of get self-absorbed in the factor of, we're trying to play a play style we're not used to, we're trying to, you know, be a lot more speedier, we're trying to be a little slower, we're not playing our game. And I think that's where some teams can get wrapped up sometimes. Do you guys have a sort of approach whereby, irrespective of whoever we're playing, irrespective of if they're the best team in the world, we just want to play our game sort of thing?
Yes, no. So the way I've always gone about it is that we have a structure. If you look at a human body, I guess, we have our torso and we have our head. That's like the thing that always stays.
Yep.
But we put a different arm on for a certain team, or we put a different leg on for a different team. So like, we generally, how do I say this without just giving away?
Don't expose too much. Keep trade secrets close. Yeah.
So like, we have a set way of doing things, and like, obviously you were at the major in LA.
Yep.
And there was a lot of talk about us as a team from like Dignitas and G2 and stuff.
Yep.
Because there was a joke that was going around about how, I think, Chicago got in an elevator with Appjack and asked Appjack, how do you beat Empire? And Appjack just replied with, we don't fucking know.
Really? I didn't hear that. Okay.
And G2's, like, from what I heard, the only team G2 really didn't want to play was us.
Really?
Because the way we played and the way we set up just inhibited them from doing their thing.
Mm.
And so, you know, and those are then the situations where Sathy or myself are then looking for, why are they doing that to us? How do we fix that?
Yeah.
Because, for example, Dignitas, the only loss we ever took to Dignitas with Seiko was when Wave had COVID and, like, wasn't calming or anything. Like, if you look back at the camera, well, I don't think you can anymore, the VOD's probably gone, but if you go back and look at the cameras, you can see Wave doing this, like, playing the game.
Yeah.
Like, just full-on dying, and we still took them to Game 6.
Yeah.
Like, just because our standard way of playing just inhibits them from playing the way they want to play. So that is why we'll always keep that same structure. But, like, we know against, for example, Moist, we need to do a bit more of this. Or against Dignitas, we need to do a bit more of this. And against, to be fair, against Dignitas, we had a very... I think they're a bit of the wrong one, because we knew exactly how to beat them. But, like, but they had the same thing for BDS. BDS with Mark struggled to win games against Dignitas.
Mm-hmm.
And then Moist didn't really beat... Moist is never bothered by many people, but, like... But nor were we. I think the only team that we ever got struggled against was BDS, because it was something they did that fucked us over a little bit.
Yeah.
So that was... So there's like a... There's, I think... And I think that's the biggest problem with how it all works, is because Rocket League is so matchup heavy.
Mm.
Because you could argue that G2 may not have even made the grand finals if they had ended up playing us in the semis instead of Furia.
Yeah.
Because if they like, obviously, you know, Sathu and the team can come out and say whether this was actually true, because obviously I'm only hearing rumors. G2 never physically came up to me and went, yeah, we're scared of playing you. But like, if they genuinely were, then not only are they going to be mentally a bit, inherently a bit like, oh shit, are we actually going to win this? Mm. They're also going to then be against someone that they see as a superior matchup, purely because of the matchup, not because of individual ability or anything, just because of the matchup. That then could put them in the top six versus who did they play? It was like, I can't remember who Fury played. Fury played Moist. Fury played Queso.
Yeah.
So then that and G2 lost that first series against Queso. So that means if they didn't have that backup, they could have been out top six.
Mm-hmm.
All because Fury weren't the team that went against them. It was us.
Yeah.
And I think that's essentially what I try to do the most when it comes to replays, and that sense is that I try to keep our playstyle the same, because it works up against a lot of people well, but we're just trying to change the small things to adapt to change the matchup against someone else.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I love that. I love the torso and head sort of imagery. I vibe with that. Changing arms and changing legs. It's something everyone can somewhat agree and relate to as well. So I like that. Really good. I love that. Now, another thing as well, I guess from my perspective, looking back and reflecting back to Sweden, obviously my first time, you know, sort of coaching on the international level. So I had a lot of things to sort of understand and understand, even if it's like, if Fever wanted a bottle of water, okay, do I have a bottle of water for him? You know, these small, minute, small changes. Was Sweden your first massive international land that you coached?
Yes.
We were the same. How was that experience for you? And did you have any expectations going into it, thinking I need to try and do this, or was it just let's have fun? You know, we've worked for it. Let's just give it a red hot crack.
I think with Sweden in particular, it was way harder for us because the only person on our team, including the support staff, that had ever been to a major international LAN was Metsa. Callum, our psychologist, hadn't.
Yep.
I hadn't. Sego hadn't. Wave hadn't.
Yeah.
So we didn't know. Like, Metsa was all like was helping us out as much as he could, and he was obviously saying like, by the way, you know, bring him. You need to bring multiple controllers, bring multiple cables, stuff like that.
Yeah.
And that was all well and good. But the problem we had, so something that we didn't take into consideration is dead zones. We didn't take into consideration stick curves. We didn't take into consideration NVIDIA settings, monitor settings.
Mm-hmm.
And so, like, obviously, it's well documented at this point. When we played you guys, Seiko couldn't see his screen properly because his settings were all wrong. Wave had the wrong dead zone.
Yeah.
Metsa was literally the only one that was playing on a PC that worked. Like, and he even had to get his PC swapped out, which I remember you guys watching. We then didn't get warm-ups because of the way everything worked, and we weren't prepared for that. Like, we were so not prepared for not having warm-ups.
Yeah.
Like, everything, like, and don't get me wrong, you guys still did really well to beat us. But, like, you had a lot going for you.
I was waiting for it.
In LA, when we had it already, we were good.
yeah, that was the learning. That was the test run. The test run was versus us.
Yeah. but the thing is, though, right, is that I actually think it helped us out. Losing to you guys first and having all those shitty problems meant that pretty much anything that happened from then on, we can just go, well, it's not going to be as bad as that.
True.
Not because of who we lost to, but because of just how we lost. When we found out what was wrong, we were like, there's no fucking way that all of these things were wrong. Like, what are the odds kind of thing?
Yeah.
So, yeah, it was crazy. But, like, yeah, it was something. But I think that was the biggest learning curve, was just, like, because then going into LA, we literally made a list. Every one of us had a list that we put in front of ourselves before match. And we checked all of the things.
Love that.
It was like, it even included like chair settings. Are you in the right position on your chair? Because we were like, we ain't letting that fuck us up again.
Yeah.
If we're gonna lose, it's because we're gonna lose, not because, you know, half our team can't play the game right now.
Something else. it's an interesting thing because you go to a LAN and like you think about obviously the opponents, how you're gonna plan the day, but you don't think about all the small minute things like brightness settings, like vibrant settings, like all these crazy small things. You just don't really naturally think about that.
I think the worst part, so what actually happened to Sweden as well, I'm not sure if you ever got told this, a bunch of people's PCs were set up for CSGO.
Really? I didn't
and
hear
they
that.
Basically what they had done is, in CSGO, obviously they want to see far away, right? They don't care about the right, near, close. But in Rocket League, we need to see the cars. So, like, it was set up that the rest, like, the far field was clear. So, like, when we were playing you guys, we could see your players, but we couldn't see ourselves. So, like, Seiko had to take his decal off because it was so blurry that it was, like, just pixels. It was literally just dots. So, like, you couldn't see the Endpoint logo or anything on it.
Right.
And, obviously, that is very distracting. But, obviously, when you start doing stuff like that, you start playing into the whole, like, the uncomfortable, like, situations that people are in because they are placebo and stuff.
Yeah.
And that starts affecting you more. But like, and so basically, all the people on those PCs had to reset the 3D settings on all of the PCs.
Mm-hmm.
But I found out that not everyone had those issues because we at first thought that you guys also had the issue. But clearly you didn't, because you didn't know about it. Only Metz's PC, I think, wasn't blurry. And that was because he got given a new PC. It originally was blurry. Then he got given a new PC, and then it wasn't. So, like, we were like, what the fuck's happened there? And so we thought it was monitor settings. We thought it was... But no, yeah, it was all over the shop. But it definitely gave us a better sense of what to do coming into the next LAN. Mm. And I think we can arguably say we had a better performance. Like, even though our placement was worse, I'd say we actually had a better performance at the LA LAN than the Sweden LAN. I think the biggest problem we had in LA was matchup. As I said, like, matchup is so much a massive factor that even though we understood how to beat Furia, we just didn't have the time to implement it.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, you can see it in the games, like, in the two games we won, and even in some of the other games, that you could see us getting to grips with it, and we started slowly but surely getting to grips with it. But the problem is with a team like Furia... Well, except for what you guys are playing them.
But when
anyone else is playing them, they have the ability just to take a game.
Yeah.
And the problem is, if you take too long to get into the groove of how to beat them, you can be on match point, and all they need to do is take that one game, like they did against us both times.
Yeah.
Because it just took us too long to get into that movement and then that groove to beat them.
Yeah.
And then we got played against FaZe, who also have a good matchup against us. Like, they were the two teams in that entire tournament that we even thought, like, fuck, we don't want to play those two teams, and we played both of them. So, yeah.
Yeah. It's an interesting one, and I think it's the one that I think I've had a couple of chats with people about this whole idea of, you know, matchups and understanding a team's full potential. Because obviously, you know, you can have arguments envisioning, well, the perfect team's a team that can beat anyone, but obviously there could be a perfect team who might just lose to one team, and that obviously denies the run, like a massive run they could have gone on. It's an interesting sort of facet, I think, where you can kind of compare teams, and I think it happens in every game. It happens in CS a hell of a lot, where you look at a team and it's like, okay, they can't beat this team, but they can beat these other nine teams. Now, is that because, you know, this one team's giving them problems, or just because they can't really handle that, or whatever it is? And I think it's an interesting one in Rocket League, because you do look at matches and it's like, you know, if this team versus this team, you know, it should be an easy win. But then there's so many other factors that sort of contribute to that mentality, whereby there is individual, you know, mentalities, there is that sort of team mentality, and a lot of things can change within that. But I think it's really an interesting aspect to sort of look at.
I think the best way to look at that in Rocket League is to look at FaZe. So Regional 3 of this last NA regional, of this last NA split, was the first time FaZe have managed to beat NRG this entire season.
Mm.
And you think about how many times they've had to play each other for top 4s, top 2s, top 3s. NRG has essentially stopped FaZe from potentially winning countless regionals, all because they had the inability to beat them.
Yeah.
Like, and you can see the same with, like, BDS at the minute is just beating everyone in Europe because no one can beat them. But I guarantee you there will be one NA team that in London will probably win.
Yeah.
Purely because they just have, like, NA has a different meta. And I think a lot of people don't realize that, because, like, if you put V1 in Europe, that is what Endpoint were when we had Vert. That's exactly how we played. Gotcha. The only difference is we didn't have beast mode. Do you know what I mean? Yep. So they have, like, it's slightly improved version of us. But, like, we quickly got shut down in Europe from being able to play that playstyle, because Europe just got used to it. But what NA did, instead of getting used to it and finding a way to beat it by playing standard Rocket League, they all just started adopting the same playstyle and started becoming more chasey and stuff.
Right.
And so, like, That's what ended up happening. So Europe went one way with their meta because of it, and then NA went one way with it. So there's everything saying that because the EU doesn't play like that very often, that BDS can just be caught out in that one series, that one game. And that then, I don't think it lost, don't get me wrong. Like, realistically, this BDS team should win everything in their path from now to the end of Futures.
Yeah.
But, like, I think that's how it works. I think it's always that one matchup is going to fuck someone.
Yeah. It's interesting. Speaking of the topic of BDS, do you think that... Well, obviously, that is probably an obvious question. But the fact that now all three of them can sort of communicate in French, that sort of that trouble with Mark maybe was that maybe potential language barrier. Now, you know, a monkey can just easily, you know, adapt a lot easier because obviously they can speak French. There's that communication gap that maybe they had to worry and stress about is now doesn't exist.
Yeah, it definitely helps. I think the biggest, so Seiko openly admitted to us that the only English-speaking team he was ever going to play on was ours.
Right.
Like he said, if he was ever leaving our team, he would only be going to a full French team. There's never, if, let's say, Dignitas came in for him and wanted him instead of Apjak, I don't know, this is just completely made up, yeah, so yeah. No one try and, like, send us the shift.
Oh, this is on Reddit already.
But, but, like, he said that even if they were the best team in the world, he probably just wouldn't join them because he doesn't want to have to speak English. Like, he was, obviously, we were his big break. He couldn't say no to us.
Yeah.
But, like, after us, he's not going to want to. And to be fair, you know, if he joined Vitality or if he joined BDS, he probably was doing great anyway. Mm-hmm. But, like, well, if BDS team, in case, he's clearly now the best team in the world. But,
yeah.
You know. But, yeah, so, like, I think Seiko was all, so I think being able to speak the same language definitely helps. I think it also, though, and this is my thing, is that sometimes English comms are worse from an English player than from someone who is not English.
Right.
Because you start using filler words that aren't necessary. So instead of saying, I'm back right, I got 50, they say, I'm going back right, I've got 50 boosts now.
You
keep adding extra things because that's technically the right way to speak, right? And that's the problem. You're all wired then to speak that way. And, like, to be fair to Archie, he doesn't actually do it. I'd say Archie's probably one of the most concise commas from that's in his native language I've seen.
Love that.
Because even when I hear Spanish comms and stuff, like, you can tell they're adding extra words. You don't need to be able to speak it.
Yeah.
Because they'll just say something that you can tell it just seems pointless.
Mm.
And it's the same with French comms, but if you're more comfortable with it, it doesn't affect as much, but it's then somewhere you can improve. So I guess it technically leaves open improvement.
Yeah. That's interesting because obviously I've never dealt with that and potentially never will. So it's really interesting to hear that from your perspective because obviously you have. But it's one of those things that another aspect of coaching that a lot of people don't really think about, you know, the fact of if you have someone on the team who predominantly speaks primary language, something else, you know, their ability to communicate, it's a big factor, right? So, interesting.
Yeah, definitely. It's and to be fair, Seiko's English, when he first joined us, so Seiko's English was good enough, like spoken English was good enough that we weren't bothered by it. Mm-hmm. He was at like that level of English before joining us where if he was around English speakers regularly, his English would just improve.
Yep.
He wasn't someone that had to, like, still learn the language kind of thing. He understood the language. He just didn't, like, he didn't know all the big words. He didn't know all, like, just like, you know, I'm sure if someone, like, is just barely a Welsh speaker, they're not going to understand everything I say either. Do you know what I mean? Like, but, yeah. And so, like, his biggest problem with us was accents. Like, my accent, he could not stand my accent. Like, he just couldn't understand it.
Really?
Because I speak so fast and I have such a thing accent, the way I say things. It's not, I don't say any most things very standardly.
Right.
I still very much say them with an extra bit of twang, which always threw him off a little bit because he'd always be like, what?
Yeah.
So we had a bit of a chain of communication in our team. I'd say something. If he didn't understand, Wave would try it. If he didn't understand Wave, then Meta would say it because Meta also speaks in kind of broken English.
Yeah.
And then if Meta didn't understand it, we went to Google Translate.
Really? That's crazy.
In my individual replay analysis with Seiko, I would have Google Translate up at like all times, ready to just ask him a question.
Yeah.
His English definitely got better, like with the countless boot camps and stuff and having to be in the UK and speaking English constantly, other than when he spoke to his mates on Discord. Like, his English was very much getting better. His written English was still shit, but like his spoken English actually got quite good.
Yeah.
But comms wise, he actually never had a problem, but yeah.
Yeah. It's an interesting because what I just thought as well is, you know, the big one that I'm on board, I guess, with my guys is this whole idea of building such a strong rapport to be able to, you know, talk about things outside of the game or, you know, anything outside of the game we can easily chat about. Did that stop you with being able to build that rapport with Sega?
Oh, no. I think the best team chemistry we actually had is probably now, to be fair, with Archie, because he's full English. But, like, before that, like, the first time I think we all as a team would constantly be, like, chatting and stuff and loving life was with Seiko. Like, because Seiko didn't care. Like, he couldn't speak English great, but he'd still join in on the jokes. He'd still take the piss out of us, you know. Mm-hmm. He'd still be, and he very much had a British sense of humor, I guess, in a way, but just had a French accent.
Right, gotcha.
he joined in with it all as well. And, like, we'd go and do, like, bowling or wherever, and he'd be very competitive with us, and we'd taken the piss. And it was, yeah, we had a very good team dynamic. And I agree with you. I think you've got to be friends with people, but you've got to not let the friendship undermine, I guess, the authority. Like, ultimately, when it comes to RLCS Day and stuff,
yep.
Yes, I'm your friend, but if I'm telling you you're doing shit, you're doing shit, like, kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm. Speaking of which, we got Mew in the chat. Welcome.
Yeah, I just saw that, yeah.
Hope you're well, mate. Appreciate your stopping by.
You can tell us. How is Seiko these days? How is he with the French speaking, mate?
Give Eclipse an update.
To be fair, Seiko was in my chat the other day. I was talking to him, and he still comes to all of our chats. And, hey, hello, Seiko.
Hey, there he is.
like at the major and stuff, like, ultimately, if we're not there, then BDS is the team I'm going to be supporting. Because I've said this on my stream. Like, if Seiko won Worlds, like, even if he beat us in the finals, even it, like, that, which I would be absolutely, you know, pissed off if we lost in the finals.
Yeah.
But, like, because I am that competitive. But if Seiko's the one beating us, I see it as endpoint still won, because Seiko wouldn't be there without us.
Right. Oh.
But the thing is, though, if you do look at that finals, in of the 8 people on stage, 5 of us would have all been endpoint, essentially.
Mm-hmm.
So endpoint's dominating it. So that's the way. I would still, like, if we lost, I'd be pissed. But the first thing I'd do would go over to Seiko, put him on my shoulders, and be like, "Look at this guy."
Yeah. Interesting. Now, we had a chat about it sort of previously before I hit that record button. But I guess for everyone who wasn't there, didn't really have that opportunity to chat about it. Now, obviously, we just sort of briefly had a chat about the major. Now, obviously, the next big one is obviously Saudi. Now, that's a massive event where multiple teams are going, but I'm interested more so from your perspective on the format, because obviously the format's a very interesting one and one I haven't actually been involved with. You know, the whole aspect of having twos and ones, does that allow people who are predominantly a ones player so much more advantage? I think it does, but, you know, how much of an advantage does that allow?
Definitely provides a massive advantage, because while we were talking about BS, let's use them as an example, right?
Yep.
Monkey Moon is widely considered top 10, top 5 ones player in the world. You then have Seiko, who's a massive twos grinder, and you put Seiko and Monkey together, you put Seiko and Extra together, you put Extra and Monkey together, they're just going to win twos.
Yeah.
Because they're French powerhouses, just twos players. Mm-hmm. Like, Seiko went to America and was just winning against everyone, and so was Monkey. So, like, you can see that there. That translates across regions. And then in threes, you know, BDS also have it, or they have that synergy. So, like, it shows the importance of all three in one.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, I think, like, BDS are the best team for showing that. And honestly, if BDS didn't, like I say this with a straight face, BDS should be winning every event between now and the end of the season.
Yeah.
Like, even against us, I have supreme confidence that we can beat them. They're still winning. Do you know what I mean? Like, I can't see a fault in the armor right now.
Mm-hmm.
Especially when it comes to crew battles. If they lose that, then they're washed.
it's good as well, because especially, like, as we said, you know, Saudi's going to be the pre-teaser for Worlds. It's going to see how well a team on form is. It's sort of, you know, most teams are going to be scrimming each other, you know, at the boot camp in Saudi as well. So they're going to be more, you know, experienced than going to Dallas and scrimming. So it's very much a pre-teaser. And it's going to be interesting to see what teams really look at, I guess, each other in Saudi and sort of do a bit of recon and then maybe change things leading into Dallas. It's really going to be interesting because obviously with such a massive prize pool of being 2 million, teams are going to take it seriously and they're going to want to bring that best form and they're going to want to be competitive. So it's going to be really, really interesting to see the dynamics and the matchups as well.
Yeah, it's definitely going to be an intriguing one. I think, again, I don't think the format... Wait, PDS is not going to Saudi? That's changed.
Oh, they're not. Okay.
All right. I'm not going to say anything. I can't say anything.
Okay, that's all right, Sean.
yeah, okay. Well, fair enough. All right, well, if they're not winning it, then I guess. This is the thing, right? I know what their plan is here. They don't want to go to Saudi because if they win a $2 million tournament, then they bring bad juju on themselves to win Worlds.
Oh.
So they're going for the Worlds win. That's
playing the long game. Playing the long game. I respect that from you, Mew. I respect that.
Yeah, that's good. that's top-tier coaching right there, Mew. I couldn't say no to the money.
I was thinking outside the box. I like that.
No, to be fair, in our scenario, though, I think the biggest part for us is LAN experience. Like, we want to have as much LAN experience as a team as possible.
Yep.
And I think this LAN, if we go to it, is a very good way of doing that. So,
I love it, 100%. Now, I guess another element I want to touch on, and I don't want to make all leaked when it comes to Go's World Championship title doesn't schedule-wise too much. Okay. No, fair enough. Yeah,
I get that. Because to be fair for us at the minute, we're looking at if we went to Saudi, we'd come back on the 18th, and then we're looking at going to Dallas on the 26th. So we'd literally have a week at home before going to Dallas for 3 weeks.
Yeah.
Because we obviously want a boot camp for Dallas because, you know, just time zones and stuff. Like, even though it's not massive time zone for us, 6 hours, it's still like, I don't know if Archie's ever been to America. Like, when you're doing that jet lag for the first time, it definitely can hit you hard.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, for you guys, even worse. But, like.
Oh, we're just rebels. We just staunch it out. We just staunch the jet lag.
Actually, what? So, 9 plus 6. 15 hours. At the point where you get into 15 hours, you basically just got it's just basically reverted back to the morning again. So
yeah. Fucking difference anyway. You get a good sleep on the plane, like I remember I got a good sleep on the plane to London. Like, LA. My plane ride to London was like 17 hours when I went to Sweden. Mm-hmm. And I just slept on the plane. And by the time I got to London, I was like, I was running on Sweden time. So I was like, perfectly fine.
Yeah. Yeah. It definitely, jet lag is definitely one of those weird ones that it affects everyone differently as well. Like, I've never really been bothered by jet lag that much. The only time I've ever been affected by jet lag was when I came back from Australia, actually. And, like, I was waking up at, like, 3 in the morning.
Yeah, yeah.
And then at, like, 2 in the afternoon, I was falling asleep in school. Like, so, like, but that was, to be fair, though, on a bit of a side note, that was because we stayed up till 5 a.m. in a pub in Sydney.
Well, probably doesn't help.
Yeah, watching the Rugby World Cup, and was like, and I think this was like 6 or 7 days into our trip. So that then basically fucked up everything for us jet lag wise for the rest of the trip. And so by the time we got back, we didn't know what time we were on. So we were just kind of like, it was very hard to get into that, like, rotate, like the easy way of getting jet lag fixed.
Back into it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I still remember that pub. It was a weird, we had a Fijian in there, a Tongan and a Samoan with us. Like, the pub was closed as well. This was the thing, right? The pub was closed. It closed at like 2 a.m. But because we wanted to watch the rugby, they left us stay in there to watch the rugby.
Oh,
and so
no shot.
There was this Australian couple was just watching the rugby with us. We were playing South Africa and everyone in there just wanted South Africa to lose. So the Australians were cheering anytime Wales did something, the Fijians, the Tongans, everyone. We were all just going crazy for Wales.
Oh my god. Great. That's the atmosphere that you want to be in, isn't it?
Oh yeah, it was great.
Dang, I love that. Now, one thing that I also wanted to bring up, because many coaches have a different alignment towards it as well, and I'd be interested in your take without obviously spinning too much of your trade secrets, is this whole idea of, you know, using timeouts and also, you know, time between games. obviously these are what we sort of look at as being crucial seconds or, you know, minutes that actually you have to count. What's your take on, you know, a timeout and, you know, what that should be used for as a, you know, more of a resetter, more of a what are we doing wrong, what we should be doing right sort of aspect? Or, you know, how do you look at a timeout and how do you look at that strategy of using it?
I've used timeouts for a lot of different reasons.
Right.
I think on air, I've actually had casters like calling my timeouts like amazing, and I've had some of them being like, "What the fuck?" because I don't have a consistent way of doing it. So like, right. I've agreed with the boys that generally speaking, we're going to do it this way, but I ultimately have the power over it. If I feel like we need a timeout, unless the boys all just straight up tell me to fuck off, I will be taking the timeout.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So like, if we're 3-1 up and they win a game, I'll call the timeout. If we're 2-0 down, I'll call timeout. Even if we're 1-0 down, there has been a couple of times where we've lost the first game in a particularly bad way, and I've thought about it.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But like, I then just go, well, I can just call it after the next one, and I still have plenty of time. I can't really explain how I use them, because I think I've had probably one of the best. Like, without trying to toot my own horn, I think I've had some of the best results from using timeouts out mm-hmm. of most teams. Like, you look at us in the grand finals versus BDS. Obviously, before me, it was coaching, because clearly it'd be different now. We were 3-1 down. We were 2-1 down, I think, or 2-0 down. Called the timeout. We went 2-1. We went 3-1. But I always find that when you use a timeout, the thing that you discuss in that timeout almost always takes a full game to actually get realized, and even in some cases, 2 games. Mm-hmm. So when people take the timeout on the final game, I'm always a bit perplexed by that, because I'm always like, what can you expect from this timeout when you're giving yourself literally 1 game potentially to fix it? Whereas, you know, things don't sink in that quickly. It's not that easy to change. Like, you look at our game against Moist, actually. It's a perfect example. Game against Moist. They win that first game, they win that second game against us, we take a timeout, and like in game 3 we started playing better, but we didn't quite get it sorted, and then in that fourth and final game for the game 7 we then got back to that way, but you know, they just won the game through that counterattack. But that game 7 could have gone either way, and that was because it was that game that we finally got back to the way we were playing in those first 3 where we won. But as I've said before, Rocket League's too volatile a game to rely on the fact that just because you won playing that way 3 times doesn't mean you're going to not lose once playing that way, which is what happened to us. So, you know, so I still take positives from that series, because we managed to bring it back. Okay, we didn't win. Maybe we should have. But, you know, there's stuff like that. So I think timeouts are ultimately to the discretion of the team, how you want to use them. You know, you use them the way you want to use them. But, I like to use them for a multitude of different reasons. Like, I think the one that confuses the most people is when I call a timeout when we're 3-1 up and then they win. That one, I think, confuses the most amount of people. And if you want to take a shot at why, I'll tell you the answer if you get it right. But I don't want to just give it away.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. No, I think we have a really good win record of taking a timeout as well and winning the next game. And it's one of those interesting things, and I love that you bring it up. I feel like the meta of calling timeouts is when you are 2 games down. I feel like that's almost a sweet spot a lot of teams look for when you are 2 games down. Some, you know, I do agree. I think when you are 3 games down, you're calling a timeout, and it's like, you know, is it too late? Potentially not. You know, it all depends on that player adaptability. But the one that I started thinking about recently is, okay, say you go 2 games down, but at the end of game, you know, at the end of game 2, you're like, okay, you know, we don't want to call a timeout because we feel like we know what went wrong. You know, we know what went wrong and we want to keep that momentum. And we don't want to call a timeout to give the other team that break because we've already found what we need to do. And I think that's an interesting way of looking at it, where you're thinking, you know, we don't want to give the other team an extra minute and a half. We don't want to give an extra, you know, minute and a bit to rely on their momentum, and they don't end up taking the time out. So I think there's different, you know, definitely a few different ways you can look at it.
So I definitely get where you're coming from, but I think, and this is the way that I can best describe it, okay, it basically explains the reason why I call it on 3-2, is The biggest thing in rocketing is momentum.
Yep.
And that's normally what carries through a reverse sweep, right? When someone wins two games on the bounce, three games on the bounce, they normally have the straight up just confidence to win the next one, regardless of how shit they're playing or good they're playing. And if you win two games, that is ultimately very confident. You're in such a confident position then.
Yep.
Meaning, but I've always found, especially with Rocket League players being so so susceptible to placebos and stuff, the longer you make them wait to play that third game is always better.
Right.
Because you are in a losing position. You don't actually have any momentum. Even if you feel like you're playing well, you don't actually have any physical momentum. You only have that you're playing well, which is great. Keep that. But you can use the timeout to maintain that while inhibiting another team. And that is why, if a team wins a game on 3-2, to make it 3-2, I'll call a timeout right there and then. Because even if they win that next game then, they're only on one game of momentum. They're not on two.
Mm-hmm.
So that means going into the game 7, you've then slowed them down, and it's easier to come back than giving them two games and having to try and stop the momentum after two games and then trying to win the game 7.
Gotcha, yeah.
And I think, and so like, even if, and that's the thing, right? I've called the timeout twice or three times, I think, in that situation. We don't actually need the timeout, per se. And I do think sometimes people think I'm just using it for the sake of using a timeout.
Yeah.
But, like, I'm using it for that reason, because what then ends up happening, and I think we've won every series that I've done that in, actually.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, I'm clearly proving that there's a point behind it. Do you know what I mean? So, I don't know. It's an interesting one.
Interesting. What do you mean, chat? No matter the score, I just rely on the mental momentum of my player to get the timeout. If I feel like they're out, even though we're winning 3-0 for some reason, I'll take it. I like that. I think that,
I
think individualism and individualistic characteristics based on that person, how they're feeling in that game, is one of the most important things. And if they're feeling like they need that extra, you know, minute or, you know, 60 seconds or 60 seconds is a minute, that a little bit extra time post-game to just maybe just, you know, cool down, have a reset, you know, maybe do a bit of breathing, you know, hydrate, do a bit of stretches. I know you boys like to do your stretches.
To be fair, right, and so talking about the stretches,
yeah,
that's something I've always wanted my teams to do. It's always been something I've tried to get them to do, you know, stretch out, get up, move around.
Yep.
Because I always find in those positions, especially when you're in a losing one, the worst thing you can do is to maintain that thought process. And if you're sitting here like this and you're just staring at the 3-0 loss or whatever, you're not going to be able to think about the next game or what you need to do. You're going to just constantly be thinking about, I fucked it. So I always wanted to get them up. But the problem was, I never knew if it was actually a good thing to do. And it was only when Callum, then our psychologist, came involved and I said the idea about doing it, that he was like, yeah, we definitely should do that. You know, it helps disassociate, blah, 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 blah.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so that is the thing behind it. So there is scientific ground for it and reason for it. I just think a lot of people find it too weird. Because I said it about doing it at the majors and, like, in front of the crowd.
That's what I was gonna say, yeah.
We discussed it with the boys about, like, ultimately, I care about how the boys react. The only thing that I wasn't going to budge on, though, was if I asked them to stand up, and they didn't have to do stretches per se, but if I asked them to stand up and when we were in front of the crowd, I wanted them to stand up. I understand that it might be a little bit embarrassing, you know, whatever. But, like, the idea was I was going to be the one looking at the crowd anyway. They were turning around to look at me, so they weren't going to see shit that the crowd were doing anyway.
Yeah.
And that was, like, my one thing of, I want you to do this because there's this reason and this reason. And they eventually agreed to it. They were a bit skeptical. They were a bit like, Meta doesn't care, though. Meta was well up for doing full-on exercises in front of the crowd.
Yeah.
But, like, I think Wave and Seiko were a bit more hesitant because, obviously, the whole embarrassment side of it. But I think I've always thought that's very useful. And so, like, even if we're winning and there's a timeout, I always get the boys to turn around just to, you know, reset, make sure. Because sometimes you can also get ahead of yourself when you're winning. As Mew said, like, you can be out of it. You can be 3-0 up and you can lose the mental side of it because you're so cocksure you're going to win that you can't focus properly anymore.
Yep.
And sometimes you just need to, like, pull away and then reset and go, actually, well, we haven't won the game yet. Let's get back into it, kind of thing.
Yeah, for sure. No, I love that. I really appreciate that. And I think one of the biggest ones that sort of stem from that as well is you know, not really the idea of having a placebo, but I guess, you know, and that's why I was going to bring up the major, like, you know, they're so used to doing that maybe at home and when, you know, when you go to boot camp that, you know, if you call a timeout at the major, would it be the same thing? Would it be still keeping that pattern? But I think it's a really interesting one. And I've shared this story a few times, but I'll say it to you as well, in case you haven't heard it. The fact of, I used to do a lot of coaching for martial arts, so for Taekwondo. And one of the guys I coached, he had a pregame ritual, which was to get some sun. So before his big tournament, before he'd go out and do some sparring, he'd get some sun. He'd just do a little bit of meditation, a little bit of breath work for maybe 90 seconds, a minute and 20 minutes. Right? This was before every big competition he did for, you know, 2 years straight. All of a sudden, the tournament organizations started having tournaments at nighttime. Well, there you go. One of those things that he did ritually that he couldn't do anymore because it was something that he couldn't control. And I think that absence of control is one of the most important things when you have a routine, because you're able to maintain it and sort of utilize it come as you go sort of thing. So I think that's, you know, one of the most important things. But I respect that. I respect, you know, sort of understanding that it might be a bit embarrassing, it might be a bit, you know, whatever, but you know, I'm still glad to hear that, you know, the boys are up for it, which is crazy, which is incredible.
Yeah, to be fair, I actually think part of that, so in most best of seven series we play, we've got to call a timeout at some point. Mm-hmm. I think that's the case for most teams. And so I think there's a part of it for Wave and Meta, maybe more so than Archie at this point, because obviously he's only just been on the team, that I do think sometimes they miss that ritual a little bit of the stretching and stuff because they haven't done it in the best of fives, because they don't do it.
Mm.
And like, so sometimes I do think maybe it is a negative, because I am like, it's something they get so used to when we're on that championship run.
Yep.
But like, you know, they kind of miss out on it a little bit before then. And I think that's part of the reason why we did so bad at home in regional twos, is because like when we would do so much better at boot camps with regionals, in regionals, because I'd get them to stretch in the chairs between matches and stuff, so they were still doing that action, but like I can't really force them to do that when they're not there with me, because I can't say for certain or not certain if they even have done it.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Like, I have no physical evidence of they actually do what I asked them to do.
Yeah.
Because, for example, Archie, so when we were at home, actually, Archie, when we were playing in the top 8 and top 6 games, I told him to stretch out and stuff. Now, Archie was having me watch the stream to make sure that the camera wasn't showing him so he could do it when he wasn't on camera.
Oh. I gotcha.
So, like, which I don't know how he's going to react when we have to do that in a boot camp or something. But like, I guess at that point, we're all doing it together. It's not just him in his own space.
Yeah.
So I think that then, that group mentality of like, we're all doing this as a team. It's not just like, so if you get embarrassed, the entire team gets embarrassed. Do you know what I mean? It's not just one person.
For sure.
So yeah.
No, I love that. I write that. It's an interesting one. Yeah, it's definitely interesting, because I think that it's crazy, because each team is so specific, and I think it's sort of embodied, and I say it a lot, with this whole idea of a team culture. You know, a team culture is a very obvious thing, and obviously for stretchers and you guys, that's probably, you know, a key asset of your team culture. It's one of those things that you've embodied, embraced, and sort of utilized as required. Now, you look at teams like V1 and their over-expenditure energy to, you know, Com just yelling the house down over in LA during group stages, you know, it's a different team culture. And I think...
I mean, to be fair, we yell a lot too, to be fair.
I think there's like, no...
I think we were considered the loudest team or something at Sweden.
Really? Like,
I think, okay. Yeah. FaZe and us were considered the loudest teams. And I remember, obviously, when we played each other, if you ever watch back the thing, all you hear, every goal, is screaming so loud. Like, you can hear... I felt so bad because I thought I was going to get told off, because I watched back one of the series at the major and I heard me going, "Let's fucking go," clear as day on the mics. Yeah. And I was like, "Oh my god, they're gonna like, because obviously you're not allowed to swear, are you?" And they were like, "No, that's fine." Like, because it's just showing emotion and stuff.
It's hate of the moment.
We don't care. Yeah. We don't care. Yeah, like we're not, because I was like, because I told them, "There's no way I'm not swearing. Like, I can't tell you." Like, my brain is not thinking about not saying fuck in that moment. Yeah. I'm just seeing a score or winning a series.
Yeah, and this is like, let's go. Yeah. I think that was us versus Fury as well. I remember, you know, we were just going hard, and that's where obviously that infamous photo of CJ just like absolutely going full ferocity sort of stemmed from. We were just, it was a yelling match. Like as soon as we had scored, it was literally a yelling match between us and Furia.
Yeah, to be fair, I think there's a picture like that of us at the LA Major. I'm literally there like this, fucking going for it after a goal has been scored or something. And like, I didn't realize the picture was even taken of me, but I keep getting it sent to me by people sometimes.
Was that the one where your glasses fell off?
No, that one. Oh my God. Don't even talk to me about that. That was, that was when I was embarrassed because I looked like a bloody deer in headlights. Like,
love that. It's an interesting one as well because what we did in LA, and I think, you know, we look back at it and we probably shouldn't have, is, you know, we compare Sweden where we were over the top, you know, yelling, screaming. I remember there's so many stories that sort of stem from me yelling and screaming in areas. But then we went to LA and during the first couple of games, we decided not to scream. And we decided to sort of just, we score a goal, boom, straight back into it, reserved. Let's focus on the next one. And I thought of, you know, we sort of agreed after sort of LA concluded that sort of probably did more damage than good. And I think it's a fine balance between teams because some teams it might be good, some teams might not be.
So I actually disagree with that. I think it's a bad thing for every team.
Right.
To not scream. And the reason being, especially in the set and especially in the studio setting, more so than in front of a crowd.
Yeah.
Because you guys, when you played us in LA, you hearing us scream for every goal, that's always going to unsettle you. And because you're unsettled, you need to try and unsettle us back. And it's more of a mental game. Because you see it in like, you see it in fighting and stuff as well. They say that in fighting, the reason why you make such noises when you're punching someone is to make them think they're hitting them harder than they're actually getting hit.
Yeah.
And it's the same thing. So like, you're getting more demoralized by us going fucking wild over a goal. than we're getting demoralized when you don't say anything. If that makes sense. And so like, and like Dignitas, right? Main purveyors of, well, we don't scream because it's sad to scream.
Yeah, there you go.
They came out in LA and said they played better when they screamed.
Right, there you go.
So like, they were the main purveyors of the, because they were like the only team that weren't doing anything at the major, other than I think like APAC, but no offense to Tokyo Verde, didn't really score many goals to scream about. But like, like, so that, I think, and I think you look at the best teams, BDS, they screamed. FaZe was screaming, we were screaming, Semper was screaming, NRG was screaming. And that's the thing, right? NRG didn't scream either until they started playing us. And I was genuinely shocked.
Really? Wow.
At them screaming. Because I'd watched all their games, I'd listened, like, we'd been in the what was it, the Swiss Abyss or whatever they called it, when they were playing. And they were dead silent.
Wow.
And that was so off-putting to then hear them scream. Because we loved it, though. I'll be honest. In that situation, I think it helped us more because we were like, they are really struggling against us right now. So that they are celebrating every single goal.
Yeah.
Which they hadn't done before that point. So that gave us a bit more of a confidence boost. But I think our screaming also threw them off. Like, you see Squishy in that game. Squishy was not playing to the way I'd expect Squishy to play. Neither was Garrett. Justin was all over the shop. Like, he was doing everything.
Yeah.
But, like, the other two, they really seemed to be just struggling with that atmosphere because I don't think in previous teams you had many that did scream a lot. Like, when you go back and watch the old lands, not many of them are screaming. You have Rattles and stuff from Season 8 and things like that, but that's about it, I'd say, in terms of teams that are going fucking mental when they score a goal.
Yeah.
And then, and now this time, all the newer teams are coming through and they're all just going wild. So, like, I think it definitely unsettled some of the more older teams. I think Envy struggled from it, Vitality did. And, like, because that's the thing, right? Justin was playing into it. Justin the entire time. At one point, Justin, between a goal, I think it was, turned, looked at me, winked, and then went back to his game. And I'm like, how can you do that? Like, what is that all about? You know what I mean? And that just makes it. And then all I could think about was Justin just fucking winked at me. Like, and I think that was like game 3 or something. I think they won that game like 2-0 or something as well. So, like, and don't get me wrong, it's not as bad as it would be if it threw one of the players off, because obviously I'm only the coach. But that's like the gist of it. And like, little things like that, I think, always affect people, even if people try to say it doesn't. And it can affect them in a positive way, like it did with us with NRG. I think it did give us more confidence.
Yeah.
But I think FaZe Screaming, they were the only team that ever matched our energy when we were there. And I also think that unsettled us a little bit. I think it took us off our game, especially in that first game. They basically just destroyed us in that first game. Yeah. And I think it was partly because they were just that hype. But, and then you look at game 3 or game 4, Wave shouted, and you know, infamously known now because you could hear it on the stream, first killer, you're dog shit, because he missed like an open, he missed like an easy backboard or something.
Yeah.
And then first killer used that as his own fuel and was like, well, I'm going to fuck you guys up now.
Yeah.
And then he just roasted, like, then he just rinsed us for the rest of the season. And was it worth it to call him dog shit? Yeah, sure, it was hilarious. Could we probably have won the series if he did? Probably. Do you know what I mean? But, like, those are the things, ultimately, right? It's like, well, you don't know what's going to work and what's not.
Yeah.
But I think you're always going to be inherently better off for being that louder team, because it inspires confidence in your teammates. If you're scoring a goal and you're going fucking wild, your teammates are going to go wild, and you're going to keep that energy up, that hype. And you're much more likely to play better. It's just the way I feel about it.
Yeah. I think it's a big one. And I don't think I chatted with Greg and or with Nick or with Joe about it, but it's definitely an interesting one. And, yeah, I definitely think that different teams react differently. I think you're on the mark there for sure. Because I remember we started getting a bit trolly. I remember when we were versing Fury on the main stage in Sweden. I think they scored a goal and we screamed for them. So we got in their heads a little bit.
Well, yeah, but that's my point, right? You can do things like that.
Yeah.
Like SSG, I think SSG were doing that in LA, because SSG, they conceded and they'd be fist bumping and going thing. And like, that is something I never even thought about doing. Like, yeah. I've always been very much a purveyor of like, and a lot of people saw this in our regionals and stuff on the cameras. We're laughing throughout like them scoring and stuff. So if and obviously when we're at boot camp and stuff, that doesn't really make much of a difference. But if a team looks up at us and they just see us laughing because of a goal, that cannot be easy to look at.
Yeah.
And it's 100%. The same in our situation with screaming. And it's the same with the fist bumps. Like, they're fist bumping. Yeah, who gives a shit? Yeah, well done. You know, good own goal. Like, and that's the thing. Like, where I think Wave scored an own goal or something in one of the majors. And he screamed. And I was like, let's fucking go. I'm a goal or something. And the other team looked up from their monitors and was like, what the fuck?
Literally. It's one of those things. It's effective, 100%.
Yeah, I think anyone that tries to be silent is just wrong. Like, I understand where they're coming from, and you don't want to exert that extra energy, but you can exert that energy and still be in the game. Like, mm-hmm. I think that's what Dignitas or something said. Actually, you did speak to it about Joyo, because I think Joyo said that they started implementing the, we'll be energetic, but we'll instantly click back in.
Right. Yep.
And I think Queso did that well. Because, like, you look at Queso when they were there, Ryze was getting up off his seat and pointing at the crowd every time he scored, pretty much.
Mm.
And stuff like that. G2 was screaming. G2, like, even Chicago at one point got up and did a bit of a thing when he scored. Like, all the teams that were in those top four, the top six, they all were going crazy for everything.
Yeah.
And that's got to tell you something. And you look at the first major as well, the same things there. The top eight, all were going wild. So I think you've got to go with the sample size of two majors. Teams going the craziest, will they doing the best? Look at Calm, for Christ's sakes. He swept his group by getting up and telling them you're shit.
Literally like a codland. Literally like a codland.
Yeah. To be fair, I think the best one I heard was, I don't know who said it. It might have been Queso, actually. I think Nick might have said it. I think Nick, and I'm not sure if the stream heard this or not.
Really?
But okay. Nick, because we were in the warm-up area.
Yeah, yeah.
Nick got up after they scored against FaZe and was like, 250 grand for fucking what? And we were like, oh my God. There's no way he just screamed that out. We were like, there's no way. There's no way he just gave that information. Like, it's not even just like the fact that he's called them out for it. It's the fact that he put that information in the wild to be here. Like, first of all, I don't think FaZe will be happy to everyone knows how much they pay. Secondly, why? But the thing is, I think that's one of the ones that might have actually pissed them off more than helped them.
Yeah, yeah.
Because I feel like that's one of those ones. Then you go, hey, well, okay, I'll show you why I had that fucking price tag. So I definitely think I definitely think that has an effect on it. And I think you have to pick the right things. Because I think CJ did something well against us, actually, in the first major, which was Cammy lagged or whatever it was, I think, if you remember, in game three. We had just scored a goal. Cammy then called lag.
Yeah.
And whether it was, whether it, like, obviously, we couldn't tell you whether it was truthful or not. Wave went, fuck off, man. You did that. That was fake. And then CJ just stood up and went, fucking come over here and say it to my face then, right?
I said,
just turned around and said, if I was allowed to walk over, then I would. And he was like, to be fair, I think the stream missed that. Like, I think that, I would say, that's my one thing I was bothered by with Sweden. It was so much shit like that was happening in the Swiss abyss that no one ever saw.
No, literally, you have to be there,
Like, eight of us knew about it. Like, that's it. Maybe the other guys warming up were probably like, what the fuck?
What's going on there?
That was about it. But the thing was, at the end of the game, we were all just like, yeah.
Yeah, literally. Yeah. Man. I think Sweden... Did you enjoy Sweden better or did you enjoy LA better?
Oh, I don't know. To be fair, I
hated the LA warm-up rooms with those shoddy chairs that felt like they were from 1940. Those tiny little shoddy chairs. They were terrible.
I had my issues with both lands. I'm not going to lie. I had a lot of issues with both lands. I think, obviously, Psyonix is still trying to get, like, the teething issues out a little bit, I think.
Mm-hmm.
But, like, with the LA land especially, I think my biggest problem was that top 12 wasn't played in front of the crowd.
Yeah.
Like, the fact that half the teams were knocked out, and, like, I know other people have been like, well, you know, in other majors, in other esports, you know, not everyone gets to see the crowd, blah, blah, blah. And they keep talking about CS.
Mm.
And I'm like, yeah, fair enough. But CS has 24 teams going, and they do two of those a year. We do three majors a year and a Worlds. It's a lot different.
Yeah.
And they're not as... And so, like, they're not as big a money. So if you're giving the top 12 that crowd interaction... And admittedly, if it's best double elimination like it is now, okay, maybe I actually would agree with top 8. Because it's not... as, like, it's just as volatile, but it's the format. Whereas with the things, I understood not doing the groups in front of the crowd because that would just take forever. No one wants to see that. But, like, as soon as you start eliminating teams, you've got, like, that aren't, like, the last teams on that, like, you win or lose situation. I think you've got to have that in front of a crowd. In Rocket League especially, I think in other esports as well, the games take longer. The games take longer in pretty much every esports besides Rocket League.
Yeah.
And so, like, I don't think you can use other esports as an example as to why you shouldn't do it. But the Sweden land just had so many, like, weird inconsistencies. For example, I had to get them to change all the coach PCs. If you noticed that your PC changed miraculously overnight.
I had an Alienware that sounded like a jet engine, I remember.
Yeah, we had these shit PCs that I couldn't get 240 frames on Rocket League with.
Yeah.
And I'm the sub. Like, ultimately, like, I didn't want to play, and I guarantee you I was never going to play. But let's say I had to. I can't warm up or practice at all because they've given me this shit PC that doesn't run Rocket League. It's like, what?
Yeah.
Like, what was it? And so, like, and it all got changed. And I remember Mateus from Furia asking, like, what the fuck's happening here? And I was like, oh, I've got them to change the PCs. And he was like, why? And I was like, I'm sure you noticed they couldn't run Rocket League. And he's like, yeah, I was going to complain about it. And I was like, well, I did it.
One step ahead.
I literally got on there, tried to play Rocket League, couldn't, got up, went to one of the admins. I was like, change my PC.
Ruthless.
Because
we
could only get 144Hz or something.
Yeah.
And I was like, at first I thought it was just the cable. I thought they just used the wrong cable, whatever.
Yeah.
But it turns out they just didn't give us PCs that were capable of doing it. And I was like...
To be fair.
So there was a lot... Yeah. There was a lot of issues.
To be fair, in Sweden, I did like how everyone was, like, at the studio and, like warm-up rooms were, like, next to each other, and it was felt like more of a reality sort of thing, whereas in LA it was like, okay, we're going, like, you know, and then there's, like, two other teams warming up, and the whole idea of trying to find a pre-warm-up was a lot more harder to do because, like, people at the hotel
didn't
have PCs.
Yeah, I agree with that. Yeah, I agree. Like, it was so weird how they did LA, because I think this is a part of the LA one as well, is that I think people that were able to do the teams that were better with less warm-ups played better.
Yeah.
And, like, because almost always, like, well, we warmed each other up a couple of times, right? But look at how awkward it was for us to try and warm each other up. Like, we didn't know when you were going to get to the studio. We didn't know when we'd get back from the studio. We couldn't. We had to cancel our scrims against KCP to warm them up because they didn't take us from the studio back to the hotel quick enough for us to be able to warm them up. And they had no one else. Yeah. And it's like, at least leave us there to do the warm-ups or something. Especially, I think KCP were like the last game too, so they didn't need the warm-ups rooms for anyone else. But they're like, I don't know.
Yeah.
Can't do that. And I'm like, So yeah, no, it's definitely a bit scuffed. I don't want to give them too much shit for it because ultimately Psionics have to do a lot of work to try and get these lands. And I think next season, now that they don't have to worry about like the whole COVID going to cancel them kind of thing, I think next season will definitely be a lot more smooth because they'll have everything sorted out much, much quicker. Because, like, for example, London, I knew London. At Sweden, they told us where everyone was going to be. Well, they let slip where everyone was going to be. They didn't mean to tell us.
Yeah.
And so we knew London was what they were trying to get for the third one, but it wasn't guaranteed. They hadn't actually booked anything yet because they didn't know if they could. And I knew the UK was going to be one of the options because ultimately the UK was one of the first countries to just say, fuck it, we're going back to normal. So, like, I knew that would always come to us at some point, but yeah. Yeah, it's interesting.
Right, off the top of your head, next season, next three major locations, what's your guess?
So it'll be two NA and one EU next season, I guess, because they would then do Worlds in EU, because that's how they normally switch it, right? So I'm going to assume that they'll probably do another West Coast LAN, so maybe like Seattle. And then they'll, because I think Central, like Dallas and stuff, while it is considered Central, I'd say most people would say that's closer to the East.
Okay.
Because what they used to do was they used to go West, East Europe to do all their Worlds. That was always how it went. So I'm going to assume that it'd be probably like Seattle, then probably like a Paris or, well, no, oh, actually, Paris. I think they'd save Paris for the Worlds, though. I don't think they'd use that Paris for just a major. But I could see like Amsterdam being used again for a major. Even Madrid or something again for a major. Like, I could see so many places in Europe being used for a major. But then I could see like another major maybe being... Where hasn't it been? Like, on the East Coast? Like, maybe Philadelphia, something like that. Washington.
Right. Okay.
Well, they've been Washington, but you get my point. Like, they're going to just go for some major city on the East Coast, I think, and one major city on the West Coast. Or even Central. Maybe they go Chicago. I know loads of people want to go there. But again, Chicago seems like a place that they'd use for Worlds.
Yeah.
And that's the problem. Where do they keep it for Worlds, and where do they keep it for just a normal LAN? That's, like, I think that's the line that they've got to decide, is what city is big enough to make it worth keeping for a Worlds, and what city is big enough to keep it for just like a major, because I think you can use Birmingham and stuff for a major, but London's more of a Worlds location. Like, and then Birmingham, well, obviously they're taking it back to the Cobble Box because it's already been used before, but like, I think in general terms most London event venues would be better for Worlds than for a major, and then Birmingham and stuff would probably be better for majors.
Gotcha. From what I heard, Seattle hasn't got a whole lot of places with venues. If they don't go to Paris next season, they'll be riots. Man, I would love to see Asia, but I think people have said the same thing about Asia, that they wouldn't sell out.
I don't think it's... I think the other problem with that is... And so, like OCE, I'd love to go to an OCE land. Like, I hate the flight. I hate all that. But, like, the problem, I think, with OCE in Asia is that, like, as you can tell right now, it's midday for me now when you're going to bed.
Yeah.
So, like, if you're trying to do a stream schedule, it needs to work for Europe and NA mostly.
Mostly. Yeah.
Because they have the majority of the people that play the game.
Yeah.
And ultimately, it's either going to be 4 a.m. for one of them, or it's going to be, like, do you know what I mean? Someone's going to be at nighttime.
Yeah.
And I think that's why they don't do it. Whereas that's Europe, obviously... Europe can obviously be, you know, 9 o'clock for you guys, but 9 a.m. for America, and it's fine. Everyone can watch that. It's not too late. It's not too early.
Yeah.
America as well, also, it does fuck with you guys a little bit. But, like, again, your viewership is so low compared to Europe and NA, they're not going to be bothered by it as much.
Yeah.
So, I think I ultimately think that's why that they don't go there. I think they will eventually. They'll have to go eventually. But like, I think that's until like the game starts getting bigger and bigger. I'd see it in a couple of seasons' time, maybe. But I think right now the game's not quite big enough to warrant an OC Lauser.
Yeah. No, that makes sense. Complete sense. No troubles coming out of me though. Like, I think being a, you know, go to, you know, like, you, when I, like, I was talking to the boys back like a while ago, like, we think of Sweden, like, when would I have, or when would we have unironically been to Sweden? And it's like, probably never, right?
You'd say that as if we got to see Sweden.
True. Well, we did have a little bit of a boot camp. We saw a little bit, so we didn't really.
Oh, okay. I guess in your case, yeah. In your case, it's better. Like, to be fair though, for you guys as well, the argument you guys have is because you are so out of it time zone wise. An org, whatever org you have, cannot really complain with doing a bootcamp. Like, they can't be annoyed at you wanting to do a bootcamp because you, like, for example, going to LA, you are what, 17 hours behind? Like,
yeah,
that is some big hours to get ready, used to. Do you know what I mean? Like, they can't just go, nah, you're good.
You're good. Fine. Yeah. Exactly.
Because I felt bad for both. Yeah, because I felt bad for Detonator and Tokyo Verde.
Yeah, just flew straight in. Yeah.
And, like, that can't help them with their performance because they've got to be shattered, surely.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's why I think we saw what realized apparently just like a ton of six mans, like even though he was knocked out, because he was just enjoying and loving the experience, right? So.
Yeah.
Love that. Charging on 90 minutes, so I think we start to just turn off the gas and roll down the hill now towards the end of the ep. And we'll do a little bit of a Q&A after if anyone wants to chuck a few messages in chat. But before we wrap up the episode, I've got one question, and I probably already know the answer. I don't know if I asked Nick this, but it's obvious for Nick. But where does the Eclipse name originate and why Eclipse?
Right.
Come
so
on.
This one actually has a bit of a backstory. So I was in school. I was in year 9, so I was 13. I was doing F1 in schools, which was like a thing. I'm not going to go into that.
Okay.
And basically, there was two teams in our school. There was me and two guys, and we were doing a team, and there was three of us, and there was three girls. And what essentially happened was we had done all the design and all the work on making our car, but we had done basically none of the portfolio work that we had to do for it. But the girls had done pretty much all the portfolio work for it, but not designed a single aspect of the car.
Right.
So we were coming closer and closer to the deadline, and our teacher just went, right, you just should work together because this is like, you've got all of that done ready and they've already got all this done. And so we were sat there in this class trying to figure out a name for our team. And, you know, we were trying to say something and then they'd be like, no, you know, as it goes between guys and girls at the age of 13.
Yeah.
And my friend Myler, he pointed at a box on the floor and it was a paper company called Eclipse.
Right.
And Twilight Eclipse had just come out. And so my thought process was, Eclipse sounds cool, so the guys are okay with it. The women will be like, ooh, Twilight. Because they were girly girls. I'm not like trying to be like, oh, they can't have been. But they were like, I've heard them talk about it kind of thing.
Right.
I wanted to put that out there before people like slate me for being a misogynist or something. And then I just went and looked at everyone. What about Team Eclipse? And they were all like, damn, I like that. And I was also in my head like, I also really like that. Yeah. I'm going to make myself name that. And that's where it came from. I once put that story on Twitter, actually. And I left out the part about my friend telling me, like bumping me to point at it. Because I just thought it was an unnecessary detail. But he got so annoyed at me for not mentioning that. And he even quote retweeted it with a GIF being like wrong to my thing because of it. And I was like, what do you mean it's wrong? And he was like, yeah, it's all right, but you missed something out. And I was like, what? And he was like, you missed out the fact that I pointed to the box. And I was like, oh, okay. So from then on, I've now said that he pointed at the box. So Miner, if you watch this, be happy.
Okay. Different from what I thought. I thought it was because you studied physics and then liked solar eclipses. So,
well, that's the thing, right? Because I studied physics, I loved like astrophysics. So astrophysics is what I wanted to do. Mm. That was the doctorate I wanted to do. So it made sense in my mind as well in that sense. You are right, it does also have that, but that's not where the name actually came from.
Right.
Like, it was only it was only after I had thought about it, I was like, damn, I actually, like, I love Eclipse, I love the name, and I just love the, like, thought process of it and stuff.
Mm.
And, like, because for my, like, even my sub badges are, like, they're different levels of an Eclipse.
Ah, oh, that's cool.
And once I, if I eventually get partner, what my plan was for, like, the extra years was to change the year's sub badges to being rarer and rarer versions of stars being eclipsed. And that was what I was going to do.
That's pretty sick.
Yeah, so it looks cool, to be fair, but, yeah.
Well, there you go. My previous name before LBP was actually Bantex, and that originated from a paper company as well. So that's kind of...
Yeah, there you go.
So... Just because I liked Bantex Solutions, and I made a YouTube channel, Bantex Productions. A couple of COD edits there. Beautiful. But we won't go into that. I guess I always love this last segment on MindClick, and I guess that's for every one of those players who are, you know, maybe in a bubble team, maybe are looking to get into, you know, competitive Rocket League, or looking to just be a better Rocket League player as a whole. What advice would you give to those guys who are listening in and are seeking to be a better player?
Oh, get good. No, I don't know. The reason, and this is going to be a bit of a long-winded answer, because I actually don't like this question. And the reason is that there is not a question, there's not an answer for this that helps everyone.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it is impossible, because there's going to be someone out there that has all the game sense in the world but can't hit a single ball. And there's going to be someone out there that can hit all the balls and do all the things, but because he doesn't know how to rotate, he concedes 10 times more than he scores.
Yeah.
And so, like, my main thing would be, if you're if you want to get better mechanically, pick a mechanic, work on it until you're happy with the mechanic, and then work on the next mechanic. And then if you need game sense, just watch videos. Most videos are pretty character about it. You can go and get general vibes, or just watch pros. Go and watch pro replays, see what they do, see when they decide to challenge and when they don't, and you can generally get a vibe off it. And if you want to do that to be even more game sensey, go for a player like Wave, Archie, Meta. I guess all three of them do it, actually. You can go to Extra, all these, Monkey Moon, all these players are very, very good with their game sense. Turbo, all of them. They generally know when to and when not to challenge. So that would be my other solution. So that's the answer for the two sides of the coin.
Oi! Eclipse Insights. I love that. Beautiful. I'm sure that a lot of people will take a lot of that. I know that a lot of people love that last little segment, because I think it's about more of a personalized individual's insight towards their approach on getting better. So I really appreciate that, mate. I think a lot of people will benefit from that for sure. Now, for everyone listening as well, where can we find you on all of your social medias?
So Twitter and my Twitch are both LOR Eclipse, and that's it. That's all I do. I have Instagram, but I've had like loads of people on Rocket League following me on there now. I do not post on Instagram. Like, I think Endpoint found my Instagram somehow and started adding me and things. And so then, Eclipse has an Instagram. I'll follow it. I think I posted my first picture in something like 5 years yesterday, because I was down the beach and had a cool picture. That is literally the only reason I posted it. So you can wait 5 years to get the next one, but yeah.
I love that.
LOR Eclipse on Twitch and on Discord, and on Twitter.
On Twitter. That's pretty easy. I'll chuck the links down below of the episode and on the site as well, so that's not a stress. But listen, this has been a phenomenal episode. I think that everyone's listening would have taken away definitely one or two spicy thoughts or insights from, I guess, yourself and some of the stuff we've had a chat about. I really value and appreciate you jumping on and having a chat and sharing some of your insights and passion towards, you know, one of the games that you love most. Really appreciate it, mate.
No worries, mate. Thanks for having me.
Alrighty. And for everyone listening, make sure to check out LOR Eclipse on Twitter or Twitch. And I'll leave those links down below as per usual. But this has been another phenomenal episode of Mind Clickers, and I will see you in the next one. Peace.